presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're going over occlumency. Welcome, everybody, to episode 58 of First Years. Today, we are going over chapters 24 and 25 of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. So this chapter starts off very differently, not just Harry not being excited to go back to school, but the fact that Professor Snape wants to speak with him. And he finds him in the kitchen with Sirius, and they're both there just kind of hating each other's presences and probably wanting the other to keel over and die. It's kind of a hilarious image if you really think about it. And Snape doesn't hesitate to pour salt into Sirius's wound of being trapped in the house. And he lets Harry know that Dumbledore wants him to study occlumency, which he says is, quote, the magical defense of the mind against external penetration. An obscure branch of magic, but a highly useful one, unquote. And Snape is going to be teaching Harry. And it's something that he isn't looking forward to, and Harry isn't looking forward to, and Sirius isn't looking forward to. And Sirius tries to threaten Snape by saying that if he gives Harry a hard time, he'll have to answer to him. But Snape just comes back with that Harry is as arrogant as his father, and so criticism just bounces off him. What a tense meeting, and it almost gets physical. They're literally about to duel each other when the entire Weasley family shows up and Arthur is cured, and that's really the only reason that it stops between them. What do you think would have happened if the Weasleys didn't walk in on them? Who do you think would have won the duel? Sirius or Snape? I think this moment shows how deeply the hatred they have for each other goes, and how that scar from their school days of hating each other just continues as strongly after however many years. What's interesting, though, is that Lupin doesn't follow in Sirius's footsteps when it comes to his behavior around Snape. Lupin, I think, is grateful that Snape brewed his potion correctly during the year he was teaching, and seems to be the one who will opt for politeness at his age. He tells Harry when he drops him off at school, quote, I know you don't like Snape, but he is a superb occlumens, and we all want you to learn to protect yourself. So work hard, all right? Unquote. Poor Harry is dreading working with him and also has to tell people that he's taking remedial potions lessons, which I'm sure Snape gets a delight in. Harry arrives for his first lesson, and we find out that Dumbledore wants Harry to take these lessons because Voldemort is skilled in legilimency, which is the ability to extract feelings and memories from another person's mind. And he differentiates it from mind reading, which is something the Muggles believe in. And those who are skilled in legilimency are able to, quote, delve into the minds of their victims and interpret their findings correctly, unquote. And so Voldemort almost always knows when someone is lying to him. We also find out that normally eye contact and time and space matter when it comes to someone's ability to dive into someone's mind. Yet these usual rules don't seem to apply to Harry, because of course they don't. Easy life for Harry? Never. And Snape also makes the point that Voldemort is able to get into Harry's head and vice versa when Harry is asleep. And that Voldemort didn't know this was a thing until recently. He figured it out when Harry had the dream about Mr. Weasley. And the risk here is that he might be able to reverse engineer it and make Harry do things. And so this is why Harry needs to learn this. Dumbledore is pensive, is in the room, and Snape takes out some of his own memories before they begin. What do you think he's hiding from Harry? And I'm curious here because when they begin, Snape doesn't tell him to use a specific spell. And Harry complains that he's not telling Harry how to defend himself from this attack on his mind. Do you think there's an actual spell here? Or is it more of like a mental thing and you have to figure out how to use your own power to just block people from entering your mind? What else is interesting here is that Snape's philosophy for succeeding at occlumency is opposite what Dumbledore tells Harry in Book 4. At the end of Book 4, he tells Harry that he needs to feel what he's feeling now after Cedric's death and Voldemort's return. Now, Snape is telling Harry to shut everything down and not feel anything. He says, quote, "Fools who wear their hearts proudly on their sleeves, who cannot control their emotions, who wallow in sad memories and allow themselves to be provoked easily, weak people, in other words, they stand no chance against his powers," unquote. What do you think about this? Do you think that people who wear their hearts on their sleeves are weak? After this, as Snape is breaking into Harry's mind again, Harry realizes that the door he's been dreaming of all book, he knows where it is. It's the corridor leading to the Department of Mysteries, which we were introduced to when Harry went into the ministry for his hearing. And he thinks that Voldemort is after something there. What do you think is in the Department of Mysteries? And I mean that in general. What do you think is there? And what do you think is also within there that Voldemort is trying to get his hands on? And it's this revelation that opens up the doors. Pun intended, Harry shares with his friends what he realized during this lesson, and Hermione reminds us that Sturgis Podmore was trying to get through a door at the ministry. And we learn from Ron that it's a weird place because no one really knows what those who work in the department do. Harry's feeling very shaken by his first lesson, and so he goes to bed early when he's hit with another one of Voldemort's emotions. He experiences, quote, "pain so severe he thought that someone must have sliced into the top of his head," unquote. And he experiences maniacal laughter and extreme happiness. So this can't be good. Something that Voldemort is happy about can only mean trouble for our order and our good guy side. And we'll get exactly to what that is in a moment, but I wanted to do a deep dive on telepathy and mind reading. So telepathy is a form of extrasensory perception, also known as ESP. And ESP covers a couple of things: clairvoyance, precognition, telepathy, and clairaudience. And telepathy is defined in parapsychology as, quote, "the paranormal acquisition of information concerning the thoughts, feelings, or activity of another person," unquote. It was coined in 1882 by Frederick Myers, who founded the Society for Psychical Research. And there's two types of telepathy: latent telepathy, in which there is a time lag between the sending out of information and the receiving of it, and precognitive telepathy, which is when someone receives information about how someone will be in the future. And neither of these actually apply to Harry. Everything that Harry is getting from Voldemort seems to be happening in real time. What does apply to him, however, is the idea of dream telepathy, which was first put forward by Greek philosopher Democritus. And this is, quote, "where communication occurs while individuals are in a dream state," unquote. That's what's happening to Harry. And that makes sense, right? We're in a very different state when we're dreaming than when we're awake. And the vision Harry had was much more vivid, with more details while he was dreaming, and was the snake attacking Mr. Weasley. While when Harry's awake, it's more of an emotional feeling he gets, but he doesn't really get insight into what actually is going on. Like, with the very happy and maniacal laughter, he can't tell exactly where Voldemort is or what's going on. He just knows that he's really happy about something. It's only when he sees the paper the next day that he realizes the reason why Voldemort was so happy. There have been several studies on telepathy back in 1927 and 1974, the first done by J.B. Rhine at Duke University, and the other was done by parapsychologists, and it was called Ganzfeld experimentation. These experiments would often test for telepathy by seeing if patients could select the correct card or image or video that was sent to them by someone else telepathically. Rhine was more focused on figuring out how the information was transmitted, whether that was through telepathy or precognition, while the Ganzfeld experiments were more to see if someone could guess the correct video that was telepathically sent to them. Another way people have looked for answers about telepathy is quantum theory. Quote, apparent parallels with telepathy exist in the quantum world. Two quantum particles that bump into one another become entangled and afterwards retain a connection despite being a great distance apart, unquote. And it says that this causes a change in each particle. While ESP in its many forms has been around for a while, especially precognition and prophecy, you can see those in many cultures, from the Celts to the Native Americans to the Maori, telepathy itself in fiction dates back to around the 1750s and then the 1870s and 1880s. And it's continued to be present in fiction and in the popular stories we know and love today, such as the book we're reading now, Star Wars, Doctor Who, and Star Trek. In my research, I came across an interesting part of an article on JSTOR that discussed ESP and sci-fi, and how crazy new fast technology is very accepted in the sci-fi world, but ESP isn't accepted in the same way. The technology we see in sci-fi is often thought of as more realistic than the ability for people to communicate telepathically. Isn't that interesting? And one of the things I want to speculate about here is why we see this so often in fiction. Part of me wants to say that it makes things easier. You know, we can get a closer look at something or gain information that our characters otherwise couldn't know from a distance. But the other part of me can't shake the idea that it raises the stakes, especially in a situation like Harry's, where his mind can be used against him, like Snape says. The mind is really the one place you're safe from everyone and anyone else. And so to have something so personal be at risk of someone coming in and breaking the door down and having access to it raises the stakes a lot for a character's well-being, as well as the stakes of the plot, if there are secrets that another person cannot know. And so I wonder if that has anything to do with it. What do you think? In the following chapter, we get some big news. 10 Death Eaters have escaped from Azkaban, and the Ministry thinks that Sirius Black helped everyone escape. And like I said, this can't be good, because this is why Voldemort was so happy. His most loyal followers are now free and can go to him. So he has even more people around to help him accomplish his task than he did at the end of Goblet of Fire. And we see here that the Ministry isn't taking responsibility for their part in this. They have been rallying against Dumbledore for so long that they're not going to backtrack, because it would prove that they're at fault here. So instead, they're going to save face by blaming Sirius Black. And that isn't all. We find out that Broderick Bode, who we met in the hospital, was killed and strangled by Devil's Snare. And it looks like it was probably murder. With the news of the Death Eaters breaking out, we get to see some of the real-world impact that these Death Eaters have had. We knew about Neville, but now we learn that Susan Bones lost a whole bunch of family members. And another interesting thing is that students are questioning the ministry's story about what happened. And because they're not satisfied in what the ministry is saying, they're finally turning to the other source that makes more sense. Everything Harry and Dumbledore said at the end of Goblet of Fire. I suppose it's better late than never. And I think this is what happens when things start to not make sense. People end up losing faith in the ministry and the paper because we know as readers of Harry Potter that the Daily Prophet has not been telling the truth, but no one else really knew this, with the ministry insisting that Voldemort isn't back, and yet some very famous Death Eaters were just broken out of prison. The two don't add up. And so faith is being shaken, and they're going to turn to another source. Meanwhile, the ministry and Umbridge are trying to control everything even more. They want to maintain their control, so they're going to tighten their grip. But I think we all know that usually when that happens, they lose more people than they keep. In response to this, Harry puts more effort into the DA, and we learn that Neville is making leaps and bounds of progress. But Harry has yet to see progress in his occlumency lessons. In fact, he thinks he's getting weaker and now has more insight into Voldemort more regularly than he did before. And Ron has a theory about this. And I think it's a question we probably have all been asking. Is Snape actually trying to help Harry, or is he making things worse? Because we still don't know what side Snape is actually on. And there's a whole question I've posed before about whether or not a Death Eater is actually redeemable or not. If he once worked for Voldemort, what is it that made him see the light? Do you trust him, like Hermione does? After all, she says, quote, Dumbledore trusts him. And if we can't trust Dumbledore, we can't trust anybody, unquote. So this really all comes down to whether or not you trust Dumbledore. And I know we've spoken about this before too, so I won't harp on about it, but it's just a reminder to check in and see how you feel about whether or not you trust Dumbledore. Meanwhile, we have a Hogsmeade trip coming up, and with it, Harry's first date with Cho, which is a disaster. I want to know from any of you if you have a worse first date story than Harry's. Please let me know. It starts off okay. They actually can have a conversation with each other, and Harry notes that it's easy to talk to her. One detail here that I want to mention, though, first, is that Cho brings up the fact that when Sirius Black escaped, there were Dementors everywhere. They were the bane of Harry's existence during third year and making his life miserable. But now that there are 10 Death Eaters on the loose, there's not a Dementor to be seen. So that's interesting, because at the beginning of this book, the Dementors were where they were not supposed to be, and now they're not where we would expect them to be. Harry makes a note that, quote, they had not only let the Death Eaters escape, they were not bothering to look for them. It looked as though they really were outside of ministry control now, unquote. And this ties into the ministry starting to lose control of the narrative and how they're not supplying answers to the public about the incident that are satisfying. And now people are starting to turn back to what Harry and Dumbledore have been saying all along. Dumbledore warned that this would happen. Anyway, back to their horrible date. Everything goes wrong when Cho selects Madame Puttyfoots to grab coffee. And it's all decorated with Valentine's Day things. And it's very, very over the top for a first date, if you ask me. And immediately, Harry feels awkward and he's trying to live up to the expectations of a first date. And it's stressful because it seems like he's not really ready yet. And it just spirals out of control. And there is so much pressure. And then Cho mentions Cedric and wants to know if he said anything about her before he died. And it's all just a huge mess that explodes. So Harry heads off to the Three Broomsticks, and this is where things get really interesting. Hermione has set up an appointment with Luna Lovegood and Rita Skeeter, and it's a chance to have Harry tell his version of events, and it's going to be published in the Quibbler. We get an interesting insight into how the media works in the wizarding world here. And it's true that Fudge does have influence on the Daily Prophet. When Rita first thinks that she's going to write it for the Daily Prophet, she says that they won't publish it because A, there's no market for it since people are so against Harry, and B, because Fudge leans on the Daily Prophet, which confirms what Hermione says about how Fudge won't let them publish it. So this whole idea that Hermione has is a way to fill in the gap that people are looking for, since they're already starting to question the ministry about the escaped prisoners. And the way Hermione gets Rita to do this is because she knows she's an illegal animagus and is using it against her to get her to write the article. So this is a big moment for Harry. Harry finally gets to tell his side of the story and has the resources to show it to the world. Before, you know, there are only so many people that Harry can tell and go through that emotional labor over and over again about his experience in Goblet of Fire. Now he gets to tell his side of the story once, and everyone will be able to read it when it's published. So what do you think about this moment? This is a big moment for Harry. He's had to deal with everyone calling him a liar since the beginning of this book, and people have wanted to know exactly what happened, and now they'll get to. Do you think that people will believe Harry? Do you think that they'll continue to not believe him? What's the significance of having the Quibbler be the one to publish it? It's interesting how the Daily Prophet is now known for lying, as we can see as readers, but is the more trusted source. And then there's Luna's father's paper, The Quibbler, which we know has published crazy articles, like the one about who Sirius Black really is. And now they're going to be the ones to publish the truth. What does that say about the media as we know it in our world? And maybe the credibility of certain sources versus others? It kind of seems to blur the lines a bit, doesn't it? And maybe that's the point, where we can't know 100% what's 100% accurate and what isn't just based on the source it comes from. What do you think? Let us know at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com. You can also get a hold of me on Twitter and Instagram at firstyearspod. If you don't care about spoilers, or if you've already read the series, feel free to follow me on TikTok, which is at veritasarahm, V-E-R-I-T-A-S-A-R-A-H-M. I talk about book stuff and Harry Potter stuff, and it is full of spoilers. For next time, you need to read chapter 26, and I will see you then. First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.